What's the first thing I want to do after we have a different president? Take a shower.
Impeachment is about cleansing the office.
Now, mind you, the heretofore document had dry ink on it for at least many fork nights
We signed it a long time ago.
It was a long time ago signed.
I thought you said the law was powerless.
Powerless to help you, not punish you.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 330. Cool. Woo. Round, even number, multiple of 10. How's it going, Andrew?
It is going fantastic. Thomas, how are you?
Doing well. Not as well as the man who's on the vacation that seemingly never ends, but...
It ends. Last day, man. No. Well, you know.
We'll see, everybody. I'm skeptical, but we'll see if it...
But you know what I never take a vacation from?
Opening arguments.
Exactly right.
All right. No. I'm excited because I'm kind of in the dark here, but I trust Andrew Torres. Due to Italian wine consumption purposes, I believe the whiteboard has not been updated. I'm not going to say by whom, I'm not going to name names. But as such, why don't you give us the topic preview for today's episode?
Yeah. Two main things that I want to accomplish today. The first is I really want to go back over the landscape now that we are sort of within, you know, deep within the impeachment inquiry process and kind of, you know, give an explainer and break down. There's a lot of different vocabulary out there, address sort of the main arguments that are being advanced, answer really, really good listener questions. So, you know, if you have somebody who is skeptical of the impeachment process but has an open mind, I think this will be the episode for them. And, you know,
Do we have to come up with another uncle? Like, so this is not quite Uncle Frank, but it's like Uncle Ben.
Yeah, Uncle Ben. That's
already
right.
Used.
Yeah,
it's already been used.
The murdered uncle from Spider-Man. No.
Well, or the rice. I was going with the rice, but that's fine. You're a comic book nerd. I get it.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Some other uncle. Sam. No, damn it. That one's taken too.
Yeah.
Every uncle's been used.
That's it. Those are the only three men's names there are. Frank, Sam, and Ben. Sorry, uncles. There you go. No.
Uncle Clarence. There you go. We found nobody else's name. What else is on the agenda?
Yeah. And the other thing that I really want to break down is a decision that just came out of the Connecticut Supreme Court. It is called Bilbao versus Goodwin. And it is a case involving frozen embryos. And there's been a lot of discussion about this because, whenever you have a decision that potentially involves the question of whether a fertilized embryo is a human life and what rights it has, you know, that's not hard to imagine how that can become a political football. And this decision really sidesteps a lot of those issues. And so I think it's really interesting, and I think it's worth kind of discussing in detail because as our technology moves forward, right, we're going to have more cases like this, not fewer. So so there we go. Those are our two main topics for today.
All right. I'm going to get my embryos frozen. Is that... No, I don't have any. Or how's that work? I'm going to get my... I just think it would be cool to get... Is that only women? I don't get to freeze anything, do I? There's nothing I get to freeze. Can I have my head be frozen after I die? I'll do that.
Yeah, it's the you could do the Futurama, have your head in a jar. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I'll do. Never mind. So this law won't apply to that. Okay. All right, well, let's get to it. I suppose our first segment is yodely in nature, if I had to guess.
It is halfway in between Yodel Mountain and breaking down the law. So, breaking down the mountain. There we go.
Well, let's hear it, Brian.
Down.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
So you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just
Russia,
say
to a large extent, it's corrupt and it's fake. Ask the president of Finland a question, please.
Okay. I hope he made a good mashup. Okay, what do we got?
Yeah, so where we stand right now with the impeachment inquiry is that the House of Representatives, we discussed last week, we went into great detail about what H.R. 660 was. That is the House Impeachment Inquiry Resolution. And since that's happened, I don't know, I mean, how would you describe sort of the press coverage surrounding impeachment?
Oh, that's interesting. I would say it's hard because I don't know that the press, which is, again, that's also a different, difficult term because, you know, there's the right wing media and then the media. And those are two very, very different things. But I would say they haven't still quite haven't figured out how to cover just wave after wave to do some Zap Brannigan. Wave after wave of bad faith arguments in Republicans. Republicans really are the Zap Brannigan of bad faith. They're prepared to send as many wave after wave of just terrible arguments to die. But the thing is, it's way harder to kill a bad faith argument than it is to just make wave after wave of them. And so I would say that a lot of it has been trying to catch up with all the terrible arguments. And the funny thing about, you know, I know it's just funny because it, more out of despair than anything else. But what's been funny is how many times in the Trump era, Republican, or I won't even say Republican, Trump worshipers start by saying like, well, look, if he had done this, then that would be one thing. But like, he didn't do that. So it's fine. And then, to, you know, from SpongeBob, 48 hours later. And then he obviously did the thing that they set up at first as the thing that he didn't do. That's happened multiple times. The quid pro quo, whatever it may be. Oh, there's no quid pro quo, no whatever. And then the transcripts revealed or whatever is revealed. Testimony tells us there has been. So a lot of it has been that, I think, just dealing with these bad faith criticisms and trying to pull apart whether or not the process has been unfair, which, you know, it really hasn't. But that's about it. I mean, because it's behind closed doors and we've only gotten snippets here and there, I haven't heard a whole lot. It hasn't quite made the news that I think it will once we get to hear these public hearings. But what were you fishing for out of me?
No, I that
you're just
is
asking because
exactly,
you've been in Italy, so you're like, "What's literally don't know what's happening." Just wanted to catch up on the news.
I wanted to get your impression because my impression from checking out, Google News alerts every day and sort of trying to keep up is that Republicans in the Senate have kind of moved to a position of kind of wrapping the entire impeachment process up in one package and saying, well, you know, the whole thing's been unfair from the start. And I don't quite get that. And so I thought it would be right because prior to the passage of H.R. 660, Republicans were making the argument that we broke down last week's episode that said, the past two impeachment inquiries have all been voted out by a resolution that was affirmed, that was passed by the entire House of Representatives. And prior to the introduction of H.R. 660, we pointed out that, A, that is not a constitutional requirement, right? There's nothing in the Constitution that says, there's nothing in the Constitution. Maybe this should be the first point.
It says a dog can't be impeached.
Yeah. It says a dog can't impeach the president while playing basketball. Right. No. The phrase impeachment inquiry is not found in the Constitution, is not found in any particular law, right? It is meant to describe historical practice of gathering information, right? And so the first thing that we have pointed out is that you do not need a specific resolution passed by the full House of Representatives to authorize an impeachment inquiry, even though... Yeah. We've now passed that, right? That's what HR 660
is. And it was such a weird, I mean, could they not have foreseen how this would go? Well, none of this counts because you don't have this piece of paper. Okay, well, right. We'll just get this piece of paper. I didn't think you would do that. Okay, so, well, it still doesn't count because of nothing else.
Well, that's right. And so let's break that down. And let's start with steel manning the Republican argument. Okay, to the best of my ability, it is a fair argument prior to the passage of H.R. 660 to say that the last two impeachment inquiries were authorized by a full vote of the House of Representatives, right? That there was a resolution, straight up or down vote by the House of Representatives that said, okay, we are going to officially begin impeachment inquiry, right? Looking into whether to impeach Richard Nixon and then whether to impeach Bill Clinton. So insofar as we want to steel man the other side, there you go. That's
could
the
they
best...
just steel man themselves? Why are we always having to do their work for
well,
them?
Well, that's
if
that's
they're not
fair
ever
too.
Going to steel man themselves, then yeah, we well, don't have to do it.
Well, that's fair too. The point of distinction, the single largest point of distinction, and again, you know, if Uncle Clarence is listening to this, this is the first thing that I want you to sort of meditate on, and that is that each of the last two impeachment inquiries were begun in the House of Representatives after a special counsel had already done the bulk of the work, right? That was the case Archibald Cox with Richard Nixon, yeah. Kenneth Starr.
Yeah, Kenneth Starr. but not Bob Mueller. That doesn't count because it's a whole different thing.
It actually doesn't, and this is a good second point sort of to clarify, which is Robert Mueller was a special counsel, right? He was not, and the difference between being an independent counsel and a special counsel is not, you know, how special you are as a human being. It is that the Justice Department is free to hire outside lawyers. And so the way in which Robert Mueller was appointed was the deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, said, I'm going to investigate this, but I'm not going to do it myself because I want to avoid any kind of appearance of impropriety.
Right.
I'm going to hire Bob Mueller to do this. And as we saw with the Mueller report, the difference between what Robert Mueller did and what, say, Ken Starr did was at all times, Robert Mueller was directly under the supervision of first the deputy attorney general and then the attorney general. He was an employee. He was hired by the Department of Justice. And he shared his materials first with the Department of Justice, right, which we saw that led to Attorney General Bill Barr getting access to Mueller's report in advance of both the houses of Congress and the American people. And that's what enabled Bill Barr to prepare an incredibly misleading summary. And again, Uncle Clarence, I'm really sorry that you're listening to this. You can go back in our archives. The Bill Barr summary is as misleading a document as I have ever seen. I've only been practicing law for 23 years, so I suppose it's possible that there are things that are... It literally omits the word not. It's bad. And contrast that with an independent counsel right? Like Ken Starr, that is somebody appointed pursuant to a law passed by Congress. So that person was responsible to the U.S. Congress and not to the president, not to an employee of the president who was handpicked by the president. So one of the sad things that Democrats did was they allowed the independent counsel statute to expire after Republicans used it to investigate Bill Clinton. And that's a real tactical mistake.
They abused it, though, because there were problems with it that allowed Republicans to abuse it. And, you know, so there's ups and downs to that.
That is true. But the key point of contradistinction here is that Robert Mueller was at all times an employee of the Department of Justice,
right,
subject to the Deputy Attorney General, reporting to the Deputy Attorney General and then the Attorney General, all of whom were appointed by President Donald J. Trump, right? As opposed to Ken Starr, who was a Republican Party activist who wrote a document that was designed to advocate for the impeachment of Bill Clinton. So Bill Clinton's impeachment inquiry began with the House of Representatives having a tailor-made document that was a step-by-step, you should impeach the president for these reasons, delivered to their doorstep. And that means that there was much less work for the House of Representatives, right, to do under Bill Clinton. There's more work to do here. And the reason that there's more work to do is because everything involving Ukraine occurred outside the purview of the Mueller investigation. Now, we have said on this show, and I think it remains an open question and one that I believe that the impeachment inquiry will touch on subject matters that were included within the scope of the Mueller report. For the reasons on that, you can see our prior episode, which was a deconstruction of the 9 crimes that are unambiguously attributed to Donald Trump as a result of Volume 2 of the Mueller report. Those are all obstruction of justice crimes, right? And again, this one, I can't steel man the other side's argument, right? because you are actually hearing, Trump didn't hurt anybody, right? Like, you didn't prove. We actually had an exchange on Twitter involving Glenn Greenwald, who's been, I think, probably came out the worst in all of this. like, it's hard to come out looking worse than the president, but Glenn Greenwald has managed to do so, right?
But he doesn't know it yet, though. He still thinks he's... Yeah.
It's amazing. And so, you know, Greenwald's position was, remember, no Americans were arrested for colluding with Russia as a result of Mueller's investigation, right? That's how you have to downplay the Mueller report. You have to use that formulation in those precise words. And that is correct insofar as it goes, right? Because there are certainly Russians who were arrested, right? Like, you know, Maria Butina was just sentenced to 18 months. We have lots of unindicted Russian conspirators, troll farms, that sort of thing, that were arrested for interfering with the U.S. election. And we have the pleas of both Michael Flynn, who pled guilty to misleading, giving false testimony to the Mueller investigation regarding his contacts with Russia, and George Papadopoulos, who gave false testimony to the Mueller investigation regarding his knowledge of Michael Flynn. So, you know, you can say Michael Flynn was not arrested, was not charged with directly conspiring with Russia. That is true insofar as it goes. Michael Flynn was charged with and pled guilty to lying to the Mueller investigation concerning his contacts with Russia. And you would be forgiven if you say, well, that seems like a pretty thin hair to split.
Yeah.
But
I found, by the way, I found an even bigger boss. Like when we're done with the green wall, turns out there's an expansion to this game, which is horrible, which is, I'm going to make more enemies here. I can't wait. Matt Taibbi is maybe my new least favorite person. He's been saying he's all 100% on board with the Greenwald. Plus, someone asked him, if you don't know Matt Taibbi, it's not worth going into it. He has done some good journalism, but he's now a Glenn Greenwald type. Someone asked him, like, okay, fine with your Russia stuff. What about the Ukraine stuff? And he said, quote, I'm content at this point to point out that the people pushing this Ukraine thing only just got finished being totally full of clown horn across 2 years of conspiracy theory. Oh, so like you can't look at the evidence that you're seeing with your own eyes because some people that you think were pushing a conspiracy theory also believe in a Ukraine thing. It's a weird thing that's happening with some of this denialism about
it. It absolutely is, right. And again, to Uncle Clarence, if you're listening, it is undisputed, right? The Senate intelligence report chaired by Richard Burr, Republican from North Carolina, lifetime 97 score from the American Conservative Union, right? Not Bernie Sanders, right? Not AOC, right? That Senate intelligence report unambiguously confirms what is also contained in the Mueller report, which is that the Russians maintained an active campaign in 2016 to interfere in U.S. elections in favor of Donald Trump and in opposition to Hillary Clinton. That is an unambiguous, established fact. And at that point, at the point in which you know you have as a baseline fact that a hostile foreign power preferred Donald Trump to Hillary Clinton, at that point, if you're not immediately skeptical every time somebody in the administration has a back channel private relationship with officials in Russia and lies and covers it up, then I honestly don't know what to say, right? Like this is not a conspiracy theory, right? Like we're not saying,
it's a theory about a conspiracy,
right?
But it's also verified,
right?
It's not really a theory anymore.
Look, no one has proven, right? If this is the Matt Taibbi standard, right, that you must have photographic evidence of a guy
in one of those fur hats,
right,
doing that dance where they get real low and they're doing
the Cossack
that
dance,
came right here and like hacked a voting machine in person, and like that's the standard that they shoot for.
No, but that's not even the standard, because then that would just be, well, the Russians hacked us, but you can't prove Donald Trump wanted that, right?
Like, oh, right,
you would have to have Donald Trump paying said Cossack.
You'd have to be like shaking hands with him, sack full of money. He's like, cool hat, that must keep you really warm, and also the aerobics you're doing with that dance thing, and then that would, you'd need all that on video, and then finally maybe.
Okay, we went down a little bit of a rabbit trail with respect to that, but where I wanted to jump off that I thought was really perfect and kind of the last point on this segment is what counts as a quid pro quo and why
Let me intro this by another thing that is happening with the media and the Republican, you know, excuses is. Quid pro quos happen all the time in foreign policy, as though there would be no like different kinds of quid pro quo. It's like saying, Andrew, quid pro quos. I mean, I go to the store and I give them money and they give me food to eat, quid pro quo. Or, you know, I like hold a knife to a guy's throat and tell him to give me his wallet, you know, and in exchange, I won't stab him and cut his jugular. That's a quid pro quo. They're all quid pro quos happen all the time in everyday life. So I'm not guilty, Your Honor, of holding my knife to that guy's throat and attempted murder, whatever you're charging me with, blackmail, because quid pro quos are a normal thing. I went to the store. There's a quid. They gave me food. That's a pro quo.
I
rest
love,
my case.
Yeah, case closed. I love the way, I mean, I seriously do love the way that you've set that up, because This is something that I think the media hasn't done a good job of kind of drilling down on, because on the one hand, again, Uncle Clarence, stay with us. You are correct, right?
Yeah.
That in the broadest sense of the word, that's what quid pro quo means, right? This for that. And in a capitalist economy, right, there's absolutely nothing wrong with exchanging money for goods and services. That's a quid and there's a quo. So you are absolutely correct that under the technical definition of quid pro quo, which is Latin for this for that, every time in a capitalist economy we exchange money for goods or services,
yeah,
I give you this, you give me that,
yeah,
right? That, well, that was the quid, and you know, then there was the pro, the mm-hmm. exchange, and then, you know, that came the quo, right? The law doesn't prohibit quid pro quos, right?
Yeah.
There's not an anti-quid pro quo.
The U.S. Code doesn't say this for that is now illegal.
Right.
That would be maybe a little restrictive, I'd say. That might be a little too broad of a law.
Yeah, that would be insane. but here's what the law does prohibit. And we've talked about this before, but I feel like we can't say it enough times. The law prohibits bribery, right? That statute is 18 U.S.C. 201. And bribery, by the way, this is going to be a slight detour, also covers the completely insane assertion that trying to do something doesn't count, right? Like, and a lot of people.
I mean, there's the Simpsons.
Yeah,
all we need to do is the law can now be argued by Simpsons GIF,
right.
Basically.
Yeah. But seriously,
murder. What is that? They don't give the Nobel Prize for attempted chemistry.
And it is so ridiculous. And I want to go on the record here. There is no question that not even Rudy Giuliani would advance that argument in an actual court of law, right?
Yeah,
because it is so preposterous. But I will say this, right? If I were a lawyer representing the House Committee on Intelligence, for example, and this argument were made, I would 100% use the Simpsons GIF in a brief. Right? I'm 100%.
Is it when an argument's so bad the judge will let you do that? They're like,
yeah,
that's fine. That's appropriate.
There is, so, you know, little rabbit trail. The only really acceptable joke in legal pleadings is the quotation from Alice in Wonderland, from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, of, you know, when I use a word, it means exactly what I want it to mean and nothing more. And I'm obviously like paraphrasing there. Like, that's what sort of counts for permissible legal humor in briefs.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Again, there's a reason why leave the comedy to you on this show, right? Lawyers, we're not a funny people. I'm sorry, Thomas. Like, it's a.
That's fair.
We're just not.
Peanut butter and jelly over here. It's perfect.
I would absolutely use the Simpsons GIF in a brief if faced with this argument, because it is that bad, right? So why would I do that? Because 18 U.S.C. 201 spells out the three things that you have to have, that you have to prove in order to prove bribery. And interestingly enough, right, and I Uncle Clarence, you're still with us. I could understand if you think colloquially about the term bribery, right? You do think of, like, okay, I slipped the 20 in the guy's pocket and he let me cut to the front of the line, right? So you do think of bribery as being a completed transaction. That's not what the law requires. The law requires you to prove three things, right? So this is 18 U.S.C. 201B, and I'm going to break down each of the specific elements and show how they apply or how they could potentially apply to Donald Trump, and we'll see where the quid pro quo thing comes in. So it says, whoever being a public official or person selected to be a public official, right? And let's start with that. The president is a public official. Okay.
Unfortunately, yes. I think even Uncle Clarence can agree with us.
I have seen
maybe
an
even
argument.
Uncle Frank.
I have seen an Uncle Frank argument that says this doesn't apply to the president. that is not true. You can look at 18 USC 201A1 that defines the term public official, right? Any officer, employee, or person acting for or on behalf of the United States or any department, agency, or branch of government thereof in any official function under or by any authority of such department, agency, or branch of government. So, yes, the president is a public official. That's the first part. Then, whoever, being a public official, directly or indirectly, corruptly demands, seeks, receives, accepts, or agrees to receive or accept anything of value personally or for any other person or entity, right? Let's break that down. That has two components to it. Number one, you have to prove corrupt intent, okay? And that really, I think we're going to talk about it in response to a listener question that came in. Ultimately, this is the narrow defense that I think Republicans will seize upon in the Senate, right? And that is to say, all the rest of the elements of the statute are met, but you can't prove a corrupt intent, right? As we've talked about on the show, proving corrupt intent is indeed a challenge, right? Like right. It's hard to prove what's
unless,
going on in someone's head. unless
yeah.
You have, after I did something, I immediately delete all records of it, put it on a super secret server, lock it down, restrict access, round up everybody who had access to that phone call, promise them to secrecy, right? Like that's why all of those things are important right now, right? Because they're the kind of things that ordinary juries use in ordinary everyday life in adjudicating trials with defendants who are not the president of the United States to figure out if they've broken these kinds of laws, right? Because how do you determine someone's intent? Well, the only thing you can do, right, assuming they don't, you know, break down, you know, Perry Mason style on the stand, right? The only thing you can do is look to their actions. And again, Uncle Clarence, we're not going to characterize this here. Take a look at the actions of the president and those around the president immediately after the July 25th phone call with President Zelensky. And I'll just let that speak for itself. Okay, so corruptly demands, seeks to receive anything of value, right? And so again, notice that was demands, asks for, right? Seeks, tries to acquire, actually does receive or agree to receive anything of value. And here, we have covered this extensively, but the law is crystal clear that getting an opposition dossier on your opponent, getting political dirt on your opponent is a thing of value. How do we know that it's a thing of value? Because people pay for this stuff all the time, right? and that's true. And in fact, like that's what the case law says, right? Like a thing of value is a thing that you would otherwise have to pay for. So one of the things that you know is a little bit of a sidebar, but we've tackled this question before, right? The difference between the Steele dossier and the Trump Tower meeting in July of 2016 is that you can hire and declare that you've hired a foreign consultant to do work for your campaign. And as long as you disclose that you've hired that person, and as long as you pay them for the work that they've done, and as long as you appropriately disclose that under the campaign finance laws, you're fine, right? The idea is not that you can't have foreigners work for your campaign. The idea is that you can't have foreigners secretly give you stuff that's beneficial to your campaign. So
You know, interesting. So hypothetically, if you were just like, yeah, I want Putin to help me out. Putin, how much money do you want? Could you do that? Or is there, does that run afoul of some other law?
Well, it is also a crime for a foreign official to influence or affect an election, right? Or for you to seek the efforts.
So it's got to be just a person.
Yeah.
It can't be.
Yeah, but you could hire, like, yes. In other words, let's steel man this out. If Donald Trump were to announce, dear God, we're giving him, we're coaching him here.
I was going to say, this might happen. This could happen.
If Donald, and so let's say it right here, and maybe we'll get some cred with Clarence. If Donald Trump were to announce that he was hiring the Internet Research Agency, right, the troll farm in St. Petersburg that successfully hacked the U.S. and Ukraine elections and said, yeah, no, that Internet Research Agency, they do good work. They do the best work, and I want them to do work for Trump 2020. And he were to disclose that fact on the appropriate campaign disclosure forms, right? That wouldn't be a crime, right? It is not a crime to hire foreign nationals to do work so long as they're appropriately registered, right? Now, would it be with Russia because they're a hostile foreign power? It might be, right? Beth Kingsley, if you're listening, and I know you are, write in and let us know. But look, it isn't part of the genesis behind the law is the notion of transparency, right? The idea that
you want the voters to know what's going on, at least, so maybe they could make the decision, hey, this person is hiring people from Russia. I'm not totally cool with that. I won't vote for them.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Okay. So the law is clear that opposition research is a thing of value. And that gets to Ben wrote in and asked us a question. Right, and said, "Hey, anything of value does that really count? Trump trying to dig up dirt on a political opponent? Suppose that Biden had committed a crime that warranted a joint criminal investigation with Ukrainian authorities? Right? It seems like trying to spark an investigation into that conduct could be appropriate." And the fact that Biden was a political opponent would be irrelevant. Would that still count as receiving anything of value personally, right? And it's a good question, but it was directed at the wrong part of the statute, right? If there is a legitimate, and this is why I said that I think the defense in the House of Representatives, that the defense in the Senate is going to move to the corrupt intent part, right? If Donald Trump had engaged in a legitimate joint inquiry in Ukraine as to corruption involving Joe Biden or Hunter Biden, even if that were to benefit him personally, that would not be a crime. It would not be bribery. It would not, in my view, be impeachable because it would fail, not because it's not a thing of value, right? But because it would fail the corrupt intent prong, right? One of the things to keep in mind is opposition research is very often true, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that it's true doesn't mean that it's not a thing of value, right? And the fact that something is valuable to a president doesn't mean that it's corrupt in receiving it, right? Like, look, it's valuable to a president to, you know, win a war, right? Like when Barack Obama managed to kill Osama bin Laden, that was absolutely valuable to him as a president, right? In terms of political capital, right? But so long as he didn't do that with corrupt intent, right? So long as he didn't hold hostage killing Osama bin Laden and coordinate it to, you know, the timing so that it boosted Democratic reelection chances, right? Like that's how you convert. It's the corrupt intent that converts an ordinarily lawful activity into an unlawful activity, right? And so the fact, and this is, I really wanted to hit this question. We can sort of wrap this all up. But I have seen a fair number of Uncle Clarence's and Uncle Frank's who are saying, well, look, you know, what if Joe Biden actually did this thing, right? And your answer, if you're an opening arguments listener and you are pro-impeachment, your answer needs to be, sure, let's find that out, right? That's what an impeachment inquiry is meant to do, right? Is meant to say, was this a legitimate multinational law enforcement exercise, right? Undertaken to help, you know, root out corruption of whatever, or was this undertaken with corrupt intent, right? And tell Uncle Clarence, hey, look, if the witnesses show that this was a legitimate exercise, then great. I'll concede.
Right,
I will back
but I don't think we condition military aid on routine, like police investigations, do we? Or
and
is
that,
that something?
This is why you're the best host in the business. That no, seriously, like that absolutely brings us to the last part and the definition and why you see quid pro quo, right? Because all of those criteria, right? You have to corruptly seek, receive, accept, right, something of value in return for being influenced in the performance of any official act. And that's what's being summarized as the quid pro quo, right? And here, the official act is disbursement of funds authorized by the U.S. Congress to Ukraine. And here, I'm sorry, we've tried to be super fair to you, Uncle Clarence, but here's where we're going to beat you up if you've advanced this argument. I have seen some Republican sources going, well, you know, like the president has to be convinced that, you know, Ukraine isn't corrupt and that they're on board and that they're a good partner. No, he does not. The funds to Ukraine were authorized, by the way, in a bipartisan way, from both houses of Congress, and they were not subject to revision, review, oversight by the Department of the Treasury. There was absolutely no conditions on doing any kind of other investigation, right? Like the Senate already did that investigation, right? Like they already determined, oh, hey, look, like we've looked at the situation in Ukraine. They are a strategic partner. So Congress had already authorized and determined that $391 million of aid was to be sent to Ukraine. That was not subject to any other condition. Sometimes they do that, right? We've talked about that before. And there would be nothing improper, right, with Congress authorizing the transfer, right, subject to presidential approval. That's not what we had here. It was authorized. It was to be dispersed. That is an executive branch function. And OMB, that is Office of Management and Budget, was directed, we believe, by the president or by those acting at the bequest of the president to withhold the transfer of the funds. That's why it's that's why we're using the phrase quid pro quo, and that's why it's misleading, right? It's not just that there are things for value on both sides. It is that the president sought a thing of value corruptly.
In exchange for something that wasn't even his to restrict.
Exactly right.
This wasn't money that Congress passed for the president's personal goodie bag to hand out to nice and good children worldwide if they do what he wants regarding Democratic rivals. Now, it's like, if I may offer an analogy, my specialty here on the show. If Andrew cuts me a check for doing some yard work and I go to the bank, I'm like, oh, I have hard-earned money. I'm going to just cash this out. And then the teller is like, well, I'm a good Christian and I don't really like that you don't go to church, Thomas. So I want to make sure you go to church in exchange for me cashing this check of Andrew's money. Is that kind of like what happened?
Yeah. Or to use my favorite analogy, it's like Democratic Governor Rod Blagojevich offering up Barack Obama's Senate seat for sale, right? And again, lordy, there were tapes.
I would say that's a little different, though, because he didn't, correct me if I'm wrong, he did have the power to do that. He just couldn't do it corruptly for money, right?
Yeah, exactly right. But again, that's why it fit the precise terms of this statute, right? He sought...
Well, right, but I'm just saying, for the analogy, that fits the corrupt part, but it would be like if he was also offering a different seat in another state that he didn't even have control over, right?
Yes.
It's not Trump's money to delegate.
Yep. No, that's an excellent point, and it is yet another point of disanalogy that makes it sort of even stronger in the case of Donald Trump, right? Because this was not an official act over which he had discretion to begin with. If you assume that it is, then that takes it into the Blagojevich territory, which can still be a crime, right? But there you go. That's our impeachment inquiry.
We got Uncle Clarence. We got him. I just heard back. He called. He's convinced.
You know, all him. I can say is the point of an inquiry is to gather the information, right?
Yeah, to inquire.
Yep. And we need to do this in the particular fashion that it is proceeding now, which, by the way, you know, now has been authorized by H.R. 660, because we no longer have a special counsel. We no longer have an independent counsel. And that's what we're doing is legitimately. I know you think, Uncle Clarence, and you're probably right. Like, we've prejudged where we think the evidence is likely to go. But I will say this, right? Like, if there is exculpatory evidence, there are Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee. They will make that known. And if it demonstrates that it's insufficient to show that there's corrupt intent, right, that this is, they will make that decision, right? The only way to determine whether the intent was corrupt or not is to find out, to get to the bottom of it. It is that doesn't make something a witch hunt. That doesn't make it unfair. That doesn't make it, that's just how criminal investigations.
Good thing zero House Republicans voted to even inquire about this. And in fact, two House Democrats voted against it. So there you go. All right. Well, in true Andrew fashion, you've left very little time for yourself in the remainder of this episode. However, Opening Arguments is brought to you by Lightstream. The holidays are approaching and you may be thinking about how you're going to save some extra money. Well, we've got a way that maybe you haven't thought of. Consolidate your high interest credit card balances to a lower rate and save with Lightstream. You can get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay, which is much lower than the national average interest rate of over 20% APR. Plus, your rate is fixed, so as rates continue to rise, your low rate won't budge. There are no fees, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Look, everyone's had a time or two when the money was really tight, and sometimes you get stuck with a credit card balance because that's the only way to make it work. That's okay. This is a way you can make that a lot better. You can refinance that into a lower rate and save a ton of money. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Just for our listeners, apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/OA. That's LIGHTSTREAM.com/OA. Subject to credit approval, rate includes a 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/OA for more information. I believe you had another item on the agenda, and that is involving embryos.
Down. 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 Down.
Yes. So, this is, I think, a really, really interesting case.
By the way, Uncle Clarence, you're free to go. But you should stay because there's fun stuff.
But if you're
later.
Pro-life, you might want to stick around for this segment too because you're going to be super annoyed. So, in vitro fertilization is becoming increasingly common as couples have fertility issues. And one
people are having kids later and later too. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. And so one of the questions, right? Like, so when you proceed with in vitro fertilization, what happens is, right, the woman's eggs are extracted, they are fertilized, and then you proceed, right? The important part is that you extract fertilize multiple eggs, right, in order to proceed with the treatments, because the treatments have a variable rate of success. Mm-hmm. And this is something that a corner of the pro-life movement is calling the frozen embryos, fertilized eggs, snowflake babies. And the question, I guess, because they're frozen babies. And snow, I don't know, that snowflake sounds, I guess they're not thinking about it like the same insult for liberals of.
I was going to say, like, are you triggered, you snowflake embryo? I guess.
No. And so the question becomes, right, at various levels, right, what happens to those frozen embryos, right? And I want to tell you, in as far as I know, in every state in the union, the answer is whatever the parents want to have happen to those frozen embryos, right? And where this becomes a question, well, you want to take a guess? Like this is where the we've dismissed Uncle Clarence, we can go back to being our unabashed liberal selves here. This is where the party of small government sort of loves to get involved, and that is all of a sudden now, what if the couple gets divorced? And that's exactly what happened in the case of Bilbao versus Goodwin, right? So,
well, sounds like a legitimate moral quandary to me, but maybe you'll tell me otherwise. I don't know. It's not like it seems reasonable to wonder if it's so. This is fertilized, so it's both.
Yep.
Sperm and egg, right?
No. I love this, and again, I want to steel man, you know, the other side, because I want to be very, very clear, right? To steel man the idea that the father, right, the male has legitimate interests here, right? Maybe we get some hate mail on that.
We're talking about things that aren't in a woman's body, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So I don't see why it wouldn't be kind of a 50-50 thing, right?
Right.
When it's in the woman's body, 100% the woman, in my opinion, 100% the woman's decision. But we're talking about something that's not in the woman's body. And both people have combined now or given portions of their DNA or whatever. So seems reasonable to wonder what the proper moral answer would be. I don't know.
Exactly right. And the leading approach as sort of a baseline here is very simply a contractual approach, right? And it says that before you undertake IVF, both parties sit down and they sign a piece of paper as to what happens to the embryos, right? Mm. And that seems like, right, the best possible distribution, right? So you would say, in the event that there is death of one of the parties or divorce, right, you can choose, and in this case, in Connecticut, the IVF provider had a checkbox option, right? And so the checkboxes were, leave the pre-embryo, the court uses the word pre-embryos here, which I think, again, I'm going to follow. I am not remotely medically qualified to opine here. The court uses the phrase pre-embryos. I think that is designed to say because they have never been implanted in a woman, right? I think Dr. Jen Gunter listens to us, if you are a medical professional, I'd love, yeah, so shoot us an email, openarguments@gmail.com.
But make sure to have your facts straight, because the last soup fructose corn syrup comments were not right. So
yeah, no, we got false.
Many
EQ.
Corrections to the correction, I yes. guess. Andrew was wrong about being wrong.
I was
essentially.
But I don't uncorrect. So
Okay. Well, I will.
I appreciate that. So, four checkbox options on this form. One, leave the pre-embryos to the female party. Two, to the male party. Three, to a third-party designee of their choice. Or four, discard, and this is a direct quote, discarded according to the American Society for Reproductive Medical Ethical Guidelines. Right?
Question, I thought there were multiples. There's no, like, halvesies option?
Oh, yeah. I certainly think you could say, right, that, you know, you would leave, right, lots 1 through 8 to one person.
Gotcha. Oh, is this for like an individual? You have to do it for each, maybe, for each embryo or
this
something?
Form, okay. This form covered all of the embryos, right? But I, okay. I see no reason why you couldn't modify the contract.
Yeah, divvy it up.
Yeah, you're actually getting at it's really interesting. You're getting at the way in which the trial court tried to bail on making this decision, right? Which I'll get to in a second. So the parties, while they were married, checked the checkbox of discard the embryos. We get divorced, discard the embryos. You can totally understand, you know, why a couple would make that decision. They got divorced, and I don't want to speculate on the motives of the ex-husband. Certainly there are amicus briefs filed in this case by various pro-life organizations, and their argument was that contract is void as against public policy. It's not any good because pre-embryos are human lives, and you can't have a contract for disposing of human lives any more so than, right, you could have the classic.
Oh, okay, well, that's stupid. Never mind. So I did, if it was going to turn on that, then yeah, no, I see why you were dismissive of this. Yeah, so that's stupid.
No, but, you know, it's...
Case closed.
It's good to bring it up. Look...
embryos aren't human.
Embryos aren't human. Aren't human beings with
not
rights.
Persons, yes. I guess.
They are not. They are not human persons with rights. They are human DNA in the same way that, you know, your fingernails are human, you know, your human DNA. Now, the question is that contract void as against public policy in the same way that, like, Thomas, you and I sign a contract,
yeah.
And you know, and I
to
say,
take
I
out the
to,
competition,
right?
Hire
yeah,
a hitman
I want you.
To,
I want you to. Yeah, I'm hiring you.
We're
as
coming
a hitman.
For you, Daily Podcast or something yeah. or somebody. I still
you,
listen to that one.
Yeah, yeah. You go take out the Daily, and I'll pay you $100,000. I pay you the $100,000. You're like, nah, I'm not going to do that. I cannot go to court to sue you. For right. either to get my money back, or
Your Honor, we had an agreement.
Yeah.
I would kidnap Michael Barbaro, and he would give me the $100,000. I held my end of the bargain, but I don't see the money.
The law describes a contract as unbreakable.
Unbreakable. How many Simpsons references can we fit into one show? This
in.
Is yeah. This is pushing it.
Yeah, it is. So there are. The other approaches are involve what happens when there's doubt about whether a valid contract was entered, right? So other than the contractual approach, right, you could have an approach that is a balancing approach, right, in which the court weighs each side's interest in the pre-embryos and then figures out how to adjudicate based on the relative interests of the parties. And that, for example, is the approach that the state of New Jersey has taken, right? And then there's another approach that overlaps a lot, which is the contemporaneous mutual consent, in which both parents have to agree to a disposition at the time of the disposition, right? If the parties do not agree, then the pre-embryos they default to, they remain in storage. And again, remember, this is one cell, right? It's a teeny tiny thing. It takes up almost no space in a freezer, right? And so, you know, there is some concern in the long term about, you know, maintaining frozen embryos indefinitely. But one state has sort of erred on the side of, unless we agree what to do at the time of destruction, then the parties, then we default to keep the frozen embryos maintained in cryogenic stasis. That is the state of Iowa. So the way in which the trial court tried to punt on this was by arguing that the checkbox approach was not a sufficiently valid contract, right? Mm-hmm. And they said, look, like, because so think of how this is playing out. The husband goes into court and says, I want to maintain the embryos. My wife wants to destroy them. I know I signed a document that says I would agree to destroy them in the event that we got divorced. And I know we got divorced, but that contract is no good. That's the hitman contract. I want you, trial court, I want you to invalidate that contract because it's void as against public policy. And the trial court said, look, we're not going to say that, right? We're not going to declare that pre-embryos are the equivalent of adult human beings. But we are going to say in this case that we're troubled by the checkbox thing. It doesn't seem like that was really a well thought out contract. It doesn't seem like there's consideration. So the contract is no good. And in the event that there's not a valid contract, then we should just default to maintaining the embryos. And what the Connecticut Supreme Court unanimously said was, look, the trial court is just trying to duck that, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is not the kind of standard you would use for any other contract. You know why we know? Because lots of contracts contain just checkboxes, right? And we try and get in and be like, you know, well, I had no idea what I was buying from Microsoft when I, right? Like and good on the Connecticut Supreme Court for saying, again, while emphasizing the narrowness of their holding and, you know, concerned about wading into the abortion minefield, to say, this is a perfectly reasonable procedure to try and adjudicate the intent of the parties at the time of the creation of the embryos, and that's a valid mechanism for adjudicating that the what happens to those embryos going forward. And again, you and I are both pro-choice, so you know maybe this is not a surprising political position to take, but. I don't have a problem with the couple, right? Like, remember, there were three other options on those checkboxes, right? Like,
yeah.
Nobody is saying, right, kill all the embryos.
It wasn't like a default checkbox that nope. They skipped or something.
Nope. So you may see some coverage of this on either side of the abortion debate. And certainly I think we're going to see more of this because of the state of in vitro fertilization. This is only going to continue to be an issue going forward. This is not the court taking a position right now, other than saying we are not taking the very extreme position that a fertilized egg that has never been implanted in a human being is not an adult person with rights. If you're of that position, yeah, you're probably disappointed in this. Very few Americans are of that position, right? It's a discrete and identifiable group that is, but it is a very, very extreme minority. This seems like a good result, regardless of sort of where, if you're anywhere else on the abortion debate spectrum, this seems like a pretty good result to me. So.
All right, but we know the judiciary has been ruined for decades, so do we cut to never being able to destroy an embryo ever? When does that happen? When is that going to affect?
So far, gets to the last kind of question on this. This was a question decided under Connecticut state law by the Supreme Court of Connecticut, which is... sovereign in terms of being able to interpret Connecticut state law principles. Can you appeal this to the Supreme Court? And the answer is you can, but this would be a terrible, terrible case to try and appeal to the Supreme Court. Because what you would have to argue is that the Connecticut Supreme Court state ruling violates your constitutional rights. And the only way to do that would be to argue frozen embryos are persons under the 14th Amendment. This is about as unfavorable a fact. So they may, right? That the time has not run on filing a cert petition. My belief is that this Supreme Court would not grant cert on these facts, even if they want embryos to be declared human beings because the facts are so bad. But, you know, we'll find out.
Okay. Well, hopefully you're right about that.
That's not to say the Supreme Court. Yeah.
Yeah.
Won't take terrible cases.
Right. But it is time to thank our patrons over at patreon.com/law. And it is First Timer Friday. So why don't you start us off with our new patrons?
All right. And thank you to LDP, to Eli Schrock, Sean O'Donnell, Despair is a Luxury We Cannot Afford, Keenan Mason. The official position of OA is that we love eggnog. Well, that is my official position. Thomas,
same here.
Oh.
Take that, everybody.
The official position of
OA. United Front.
Is that we love eggnog. Did I tell you I have 3-year-old aged eggnog?
I was going to say, I know you probably make your own eggs.
Oh. It's so good. All right.
I don't know what the Supreme Court's going to say about them, but you make your own eggs and then the nog from them.
Sterling Price, Frank Desimone, Anthony P., and ATC. Take it away, Thomas.
And thank you, Solomon Basir, Indy Canary JD, Tom Dunn, Ellie Brocious, Megan H., Stacy Farnham, and Lavocat Andrew Toro. I'm not sure what that is. Sorry. There's a symbol in there, too, that I can't read. But anyway, thank you, new patrons. Can't wait to get back to our goodies. It may require Andrew being in the country, so I know we delayed a little bit on the Q&A, but we'll get back to it. Don't worry. It's coming. Coming very soon. Assuming they let Andrew back into the country. I don't know if Trump will allow that. But now it is time for T3BE. And I think I'm on a good run, right? I don't remember.
You just got a real property question, right? So,
well, that's great.
You can't do better than that, right?
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
All right, Thomas, we have a contracts question for you. So if you can handle real property, this should be a walk in the park, right? A carpenter contracted with a homeowner to remodel the homeowner's home for $10,000, the contract price to be paid on completion of the work. On May 29th, relying on his expectation that he would finish the work and have the homeowner's payment on June 1, the carpenter contracted to buy a car under the following terms: $10,000 in cash if payment is made on June 1. If payment is made thereafter, the price is $12,000. The carpenter completed the work according to specifications on June 1 and demanded payment from the homeowner on that date. The homeowner, without any excuse, refused to pay. As a result, the carpenter became very excited, suffered a minor heart attack, and incurred related medical expenses of $4,000.
Oh my God.
The reasonable value of the carpenter's services in remodeling the home was $13,000.
Oh my gosh.
So, in an action by the carpenter against the homeowner, which of the following should be the carpenter's measure of recovery? A, $10,000, the contract price. B, $14,000. That's the contract price, plus $4,000 for the medical expenses incurred because the homeowner refused to pay. C, $12,000, which is the contract price, plus $2,000, which is the bargain that was lost because the carpenter could not pay cash for the car on June 1.
This is a great question.
Or D, $13,000, the amount that the homeowner was enriched by the carpenter's services. Yeah, I love this question. I'm really excited.
And think of how many combinations they left out that I'm, you know, that I fortunately don't have to choose from.
E.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's tough. lots going on here. This is a tough one. I'm skeptical of this $2,000 bargain question. I mean, it's part of it is reasonable. Like, okay, well, he wasn't able to do that, so therefore it's kind of the cause of losing out on $2,000, the bargain for the car. At the same time, I feel like you could easily stretch that into being absurd. Like if some guy's like, I've got a surefire business plan for you. If you put down $10,000, I'll give you $1 million the next day. And so therefore you have $990,000 of damages. Like that could seem ridiculous on the $10,000 job. So I'm skeptical of that premise for that reason, because I don't think that's sustainable, but I don't know. I could be wrong. It might be, but I'm so the one I'm most skeptical of is that $2,000. The homeowner, without any excuse, refused to pay. As a result, the carpenter became very excited, suffered a minor heart attack. So the medical expenses, I'm also a little skeptical of that, because that's sort of like I think we've talked about like the glass person, whatever principle. If you punch someone and they just shatter into glass, like, are you a murderer or what? I don't know. I can't remember. But let's see. A is just $10,000. Gosh. And then again, the reasonable value of the carpenter's services was 13. So I'm skeptical of all of it. I don't know, because if they didn't pay by the deadline, is there a reason that you would get the reasonable value versus what you agreed to? I'm actually not even sure that's true. Like, I could see some sort of penalties, but I don't really know how you'd figure that necessarily to be 13,000. If it's like, okay, you didn't pay me on time, therefore I'm going to win in an action a greater amount than I was going to charge you because it's the reasonable value. I honestly, I'm kind of struggling to see the logic. Usually when we do these questions, the question is, what did I lose out on by you not paying me, essentially? And these are all kind of plausible, but also there's the idea of wanting to be able to break the contract if it would be good for commerce or whatever. That's kind of what you've talked about before. So A, you've got 10,000, the contract price, which is like, that's an answer. That's plausible to me. As much as it seems unfair that you wouldn't get anything, I don't know. These are kind of tenuous, these damages. B, $14,000, the contract price plus the medical expenses. Getting excited by not being paid and having a heart attack, it just seems a little too, it doesn't seem like it's right after, I can't remember the legal term you always use, approximate cause or whatever. You have a heart problem. You can't just get excited and suffer a heart. If getting excited gives you a heart attack, then, you know, what happens when you have sex with your wife or something? Like, are you having a heart attack every night? I don't feel like getting excited is enough reason why this person's liable for these expenses. C, $12,000, the contract price plus $2,000, the bargain that was lost. That's close, but I don't know. Again, you could take that to absurdity. If you lost like a $1 billion bargain, it seems like that wouldn't be reasonable. So by that logic, I don't really like B or C. D, $13,000, the amount the homeowner was enriched by the carpenter's services. Now I see the logic. The logic is, you've broken the contract, so now I'm just going to go after the amount that you were enriched by my services. Now I see that logic. So I'm kind of between A or D, believe it or not. And this could be so bad that I honestly could be between B or C, and I'm just so far off. But, I'm going to go, D is really jumping out at me. So I'm going to go D, $13,000, the amount the homeowner was enriched by the carpenter services. I just, that one is jumping out to me. I think the other ones are too loosey-goosey in terms of being actual damages. So D is my final answer. I was between A, B, C, and D. But no, I was Thomas's second chance was kind of A and D because I'm really just a stickler with these damages, I guess. But I'm going to go with D, final answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play along, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. And by the way, I will be back in the country, so I will actually pick the winner and read them out, and future Andrew will hop out of the DeLorean, and it'll be amazing. So this is one you want to play along with, I think.
All right, nice hard sell. I like it.
Well, we need to make sure people keep playing. Actually, lots of people play T3B.
Yeah, they do. And this is a really tricky one. I'm excited to see people's answers to this one because this was tricky. All right, well, that's our show today. Thanks, Andrew, for another Via Italy, another deep dive, another yodel session. We need it. The people need you, and I'm so glad that you were able to do it. We appreciate you. So thanks so much, and we will see everybody next time.
Bye-bye.
You betrayed the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.